Hello and welcome to the House Magazine's podcast to mark International Women's Day and the release of Women in Westminster, the 100. Women in Westminster recognises 100 of the most influential and inspiring women currently working in Westminster. This year's list includes politicians of all the main political parties, lobby journalists, heroes of the pandemic, campaigners, and a few surprising entries. To see this year's 100, visit www.womeninwestminster.co.uk or check out the latest edition of The House magazine. I am delighted to be joined by one of our patrons, Caroline Noakes, the chair of the Women and Equality Select Committee and guest editor of the latest edition of The House magazine. This year, our patrons also identified 15 ones to watch, women we think will make their mark on British public life in the years to come. We're joined by one of these women, Charlotte Nicholls. Charlotte has been Labour MP for Warrington North for just over a year, and what a year! And she's also part of the opposition's equalities team. We're also joined by Fiona Cannon, Group Sustainable Business Director for Lloyds Banking Group, who kindly supported this year's Women in Westminster. And I'm Rosa Prince, I'm the editor of The House. We've gathered these impressive women together to talk about the women that will be the first names on their team sheet of their all-time Women in Westminster list. And to help us with that, we've asked them to each name a political hero from the past and the current one. Charlotte, perhaps you can kick us off. You've chosen someone interesting, Eleanor Marx. What is it about Eleanor Marx you most admire?
Well, Eleanor Marx was one of the founders of the trade union, the GMB, and I think that as a trade unionist before coming into Parliament, that she's someone that's really inspired me throughout my political life, particularly at a time when women weren't as big a feature in trade unions as they are today. And of course, many of those struggles, particularly in terms of women in leadership positions within the trade union movement, equal pay for women fought for by the trade union movement, are still yet to be achieved. So I think she's really been a driving influence behind my work.
So that sounds like you think that there's something that politicians of today can still learn from Eleanor Marx.
Absolutely. I think that she understood the dangers of things like scapegoating refugees and migrants. She was very involved in the 1890s in working with the TUC to ensure that Jewish refugees from Eastern and Central Europe were able to enter Britain, of course, coming from that sort of heritage background herself. And I think that she was one of those people that, despite the fact that she had a lot of privileges in life, you know, her father was Karl Marx, they were a wealthy family, generally speaking, very influential within politics, she never forgot that aspect of where she came from and made sure that she was fighting for the rights of everyone to experience the same sorts of privileges that she had.
Caroline, you've also chosen someone from outside of Parliament and someone whose name has become familiar to us all over again in the last few months, Florence Nightingale. Why did you choose her?
A number of reasons. Firstly, she was a pioneer in her field. Everyone thinks of Florence Nightingale as just being a nurse, but actually she was a mathematician and statistician and was incredibly persuasive. So she was the woman that convinced Palmerston of the need to introduce her methods so that out in the Crimea there were more sterile, more hygienic medical methods going on. And of course, she lived in my constituency. That provoked a bit of a row between me and Pauline Latham, the MP for one of the Derbyshire seats, who was convinced that Florence lived in her constituency. She grew up in mine and is buried in the churchyard of the village that I live in. And so I sort of grew up with Florence Nightingale as a local example of somebody who, against the odds, could make a difference as a woman in a very heavily dominated man's world. I always regarded her as a politician, although one outside of Westminster, for her persuasive abilities and the fact that she really got things done. And I just think it's at this time when we are so grateful and appreciative of the nursing profession and everything they've done through the pandemic, it really strikes me that Florence is somebody that we look up to now and should continue to look up to in hundreds of years' time.
Now, she's someone who is among many, really, whose role has been reconsidered in the light of recent events, questioning whether she held views that would today be considered perhaps racist or even then, maybe. Do you think that expects too much of her? Do you think we generally want our female role models to be sort of paragons of virtue?
I think we want all of our role models to uphold the highest standards. I think you have to look at Florence in the context of the time that she existed in. But also, we need to be so much better at understanding our history and being happy, being able to be critical of people who might otherwise just have been portrayed as being perfect in every respect. Nobody is. Indeed, nobody was. And I think we've got a massive piece of work to do, not necessarily reinterpreting our history, but understanding it better and looking at the flaws that existed in individuals and being able to recognise their strengths and their weaknesses.
And given that the two of you have both chosen women who were not in Westminster, as you say, do you think that's something that women today can do? Do you need to be elected these days to be able to achieve real change? Or is that something, I'm thinking of Kate Bingham at the moment. Is there a role for activism outside of Westminster politics?
Well, I now and repeatedly hold up Kate Bingham as a brilliant example of a woman that just gets things done. And I think that's one of the challenges that we face, is that we want to attract brilliant, hardworking, determined, visionary women into Westminster. But we also have to work out how we can harness the skills of those who are outside the political arena. And I look at some of the activists that I've worked with over the past 10, 11 years. And I know that perhaps some of the best, most able politicians have never ventured into Parliament. And I think there's a massive job for all of us to do, convincing people to stand in the first place, but also recognising that campaigners on the outside sometimes can get more done. And that can be really frustrating, you know, both as a backbench MP, as a select committee chair, as a minister, to know that actually there are people on the outside who are achieving more than you are.
Now, you discussed some of these issues with your colleague, your former colleague, Amber Rudd, for the latest edition of The House, which, as we said, you have guest edited. And you had an interesting discussion about the difference in perhaps attitude and progress when it comes to equality between Parliament and the private sector. Let's hear a bit of that now.
And having gone back to the private sector after 10 years, do you think that that transition is easier for female former politicians than male? Did you find it particularly difficult, challenging?
Well, I think it was not too difficult for me because I had a career in the private sector. Then the aberrational way was going to politics and then coming out again. So I think that there's much more, it's easier if you've done that way, so you've had a sort of combination of the two. But also I found that the private sector, since I left it, is much more gender neutral, which is great. I mean, today we've had the report of the Hampton Alexander, where, as we know, their challenge was to the private sector to get to 33%, I think it was, of women on FTSE 350 boards. And they've exceeded that. Now, there's all sorts of ways of saying, yes, but there aren't enough in the pipeline, there aren't enough executives. But the fact is, 35%, they've done it. And at the same time, we have seen women in cabinet go backwards in terms of the numbers. I read that, I think, in your report, Caroline, just recently. So it's just an indication the private sector has managed to, you know, make equality much more real, and politicians have not.
I think that's really true. And just shining a light on it. So I think the Hampton Alexander review that we saw come in, identifying that there isn't a single FTSE 350 company without a woman on the board. Does shining a light in that way help? And is that what we should be doing in Parliament? Permanently emphasising that there's not enough women, that we need to get to a 50-50 Parliament, that we have to have better representation at ministerial level?
I think we do have to. We have to continually point it out. And I don't know whether anybody else has pointed it out today, but there is a deep irony in the government congratulating the private sector on having achieved this target. And they themselves, the cabinet, the amount of women who are ministers, have gone backwards since at least 2014, as far as I can see. I mean, the last all-male cabinet was in 1992. And in fact, Margaret Thatcher, in her 11 years, only had one woman cabinet member. But the numbers for women in cabinet are still tiny. I mean, cumulatively, I was the fifth woman only to hold a great office of state. I think there have been 46 women cabinet ministers total. And at the moment, well, Caroline, you may know this better than me, but is it? It's just under 25%, I think.
And we're backwards with the appointment of Lord Frost to cabinet.
Exactly. And I mean, and even though Lord Frost has played, obviously, an important part in the government over the past year or so, it does nevertheless look very much like it's part of that gang of men who trust each other, and where a woman is a kind of an exception rather than part of an inner circle.
And do you think that's it? So the boys are a part of the club and the women are on the outside?
It does feel like that. It feels like that in the language they use as well, which I find so patronising. I saw recently that government responded to something either you or I had said, I'm not quite sure which of us, was pointing out the fact that there was a lack of women ministers or cabinet ministers. And they responded by saying, there are some very bright young women in Parliament who I'm sure will make it into cabinet in time. It's treating women as though they're children. And this idea that women rather than men need a special treatment, special indulgence, it's just absurd. And it reflects an attitude towards women that belongs in the 19th century.
You can read the whole of that interview in the latest edition of The House magazine. Fiona, do you agree that the private sector is ahead of politics when it comes to equality?
Business has been working on this issue for a number of years now. And I think one of the things that we have seen that has been most noticeable is business voluntarily looking to set targets, for example, around gender. So I was a member of the Hampton Alexander review to increase the number of women on boards and into executive positions. And actually what's been striking about that is that a voluntarily business-led, with the support of government, voluntarily picking up targets, looking at data, being transparent. And so I think that has led to a real shift in terms of numbers. So for example, at the moment, we've got now got 33% of women on boards across the FTSE 350 and about almost 31% of women in executive positions. Now, clearly, there's a lot more to do on that. But I think just the scale of that progress, I think, has been really encouraging. And so I think there has been a lot of progress made in the private sector, but equally, you know, lots of progress being made in Westminster too. But I think the private sector has been looking at this because this is a real business issue for the private sector. If you think that, you know, gender equality, which I do and lots of other people do think is a real business issue, then actually that's where it's easier, I think, to be able to make the arguments when you can see an impact on the bottom line.
Thank you. Now, Charlotte, you worked in trade unions before becoming an MP. Tell us about the contrast between the union movement and Westminster. Where does gender equality lie in each of those?
I think it's a very interesting question. I mean, from my point of view, they are two very much linked things. You know, going back to Eleanor Marx as a kind of political hero, you know, she was as involved in the establishment of the trade union GMB as she was in the establishment of the Labour Party itself. And I think they're very much interwoven things. Many of the policies which the Labour Party holds up as some of its proudest achievements are things that were struggles and fights that were born out of the trade union movement. And I think to go back to Caroline's point earlier about people outside of the political arena doing really good things, it is often trade union women doing that. I mean, we've seen the biggest march last year for equal pay in Glasgow, for example, led by women trade unionists, you know, in sectors like care, for example, which are overwhelmingly led by women. I think that within politics, certainly within the Labour Party, we've made a number of strides. I'm proud to be part of a parliamentary Labour Party that's actually majority women for the first time in the party's history, and certainly the first major party that's achieved that within Westminster. However, you know, we still haven't had a woman leader. Women are still underrepresented in local government in particular. So there's a lot of work to do. And I think we've seen in the trade union movement in recent years, particularly at that very senior level, a lot of real shifts. So, you know, Frances O'Grady, as the General Secretary of the TUC, for example, has been doing an amazing job speaking up for women trade unionists. Unison, which is the largest trade union, has just elected its first female General Secretary, which, given that it's a union that's overwhelmingly women, I mean, there is a question why it's taken them so long to do so. But I think that we can't look at either Westminster or the trade union movement as having sort of fully squared that circle in terms of gender equality yet. But I think both institutions are, you know, really working hard on this issue. And I think both kind of help keep each other honest in a way on that front.
Also in their discussion, Caroline and Amber spoke about Westminster still being a bit of a boys' club and being on the end of remarks that they found pretty shocking and that they weren't aware of elsewhere in public life. Is that something you've experienced too?
Yeah, and I think certainly being one of the youngest women in Parliament, I was 28 when I was elected, there is very much a view of what MPs look like that I don't necessarily fit into. So particularly when I was first elected, I was regularly confused for being a member of my own staff team, as women who look like me in Westminster tend to be, you know, researchers for MPs rather than MPs in their own right, for example. You know, you do find sometimes that your expertise on certain issues isn't assumed in the way that it is for men, even when it was on things to do with issues such as industrial strategy, for example, which I'd been working on for a long time before coming into Parliament. But I think the longer I've been there and the more that you're able to have conversations with different stakeholders within Parliament, within different organisations, and kind of gaining that respect, I suppose, that's become less of an issue as things have gone on. But I think there is still a long way to go. I mean, just yesterday, for example, there was an urgent question by my colleague, the Shadow Secretary of State, Marcia de Cordova, where the BBC confused her and the Shadow Minister, Kemi Badenoch, for each other, despite the fact that they don't look remotely alike, because they're both Black women. And that's something that I often joke about with women colleagues, and particularly with Black women colleagues who seem to get it even more frequently, that, you know, the number of men who look like boiled eggs pottering around Westminster who never get confused for each other, despite the fact that they do look very similar, and women who don't look remotely alike who are constantly confused for each other. I mean, I found that I was regularly getting confused for Deanna Davison, for Angela Rayner, for Holly Lynch, you know, people that I don't look anything like, just because they are, you know, young-ish women knocking about Westminster. And I think that's one of the real things that needs to change.
Now we're going to turn to some of our current heroes. Fiona, I think you chose Harriet Harman, a real champion of gender equality. Do you want to tell us why you picked her?
Yes. I mean, one of my earlier kind of inspirations, if you like, I guess largely because of the work that I do, was Barbara Castle, you know, in terms of being on the side of the women in Dagenham Motor Plant and the women sewing machinists in Dagenham, and then kind of introducing the Equal Pay Act at a time when that was kind of, you know, pretty difficult things to have achieved. And I think Harriet has kind of picked up and carried on with that tradition, if you like. I mean, she is somebody who has throughout her career really fought for women. She set up the first Parliamentary Party Women's Group, campaigned to prevent Labour having all male shadow cabinets, for example, fought for more Labour MPs through women only shortlists. And I guess the thing that for me that has made a big difference in my work, if you like, is the work she did around the Equality Act and introduced the gender pay gap reporting. And I think that was a real transformative moment. As Charlotte said, we haven't achieved equal pay, but the transparency that having the gender pay reporting has allowed to happen has been really important, I think. I mean, on one level, it tells us something we already know, which is that there are too few women in senior positions, but the having to report it publicly and to be held to account of it from a company's perspective, I think has really meant that that allows people to take action internally. And it also allows women, young women in particular, to look at the companies who are doing well in this space and those who aren't, and been able to kind of think about where they might want to go to work. So I think for those reasons, I think Harriet has had a real impact and is one of the reasons why I chose her.
Now, when Labour were in power, Harriet Harman was sort of mocked a bit and called names like Harriet Harpers. And now she's rather transformed and is seen as something of a hero to women in all parties in Westminster. Do you think female politicians often get treated like that? If they have opinions, they're sort of knocked down a bit.
From my perspective, then absolutely. And I think that has happened to women wherever they've worked over the years. And I think it's, you know, the fact that Harriet and others were kind of pushing for something that at the time was seen as quite radical and different. But actually now, as the world has changed with the huge social and demographic changes that we've seen, actually the issues that she was pushing for actually are very kind of commonplace now. And so if I think from that perspective, that's why there's been a kind of transformation in terms of how she's perceived, because she was just an early adopter of things that we now all recognise as being the hallmarks of a modern society and modern company.
Now, Harriet Harman has said that Westminster remains sexist. I think we've heard a bit of that as well from both Charlotte and Caroline. What about you? Have you experienced sexism or misogyny in your working career?
I don't think there's any woman who's been around in any kind of sector for any length of time that won't have experienced some kind of sexism. I started my kind of working career over 35 years ago now. And so when I first started, all the issues that we've been talking about so far were very, very real. There were very few women in positions of leadership at that stage. And some of those issues, I think, still persist today. So even when you think about, you know, if you say to someone, what does a leader look like, then typically people will think automatically that it looks like a man. And so I think those, some of those issues still prevail. But I think the biggest challenge really is that actually our workforces, our workplaces are just not set up to deal with the way we all live our lives now. If you think about how most workplaces are set up, they're kind of based on a what you might call 19th century model work, so 9 to 5, 5 days a week, basically set up by men for men and predicated on the idea that someone was in the workplace, normally a man, and somebody was in the home, normally a woman. And all of our systems are really kind of built around that. And so I think that in and of itself means that, you know, that we all as women and anybody who's slightly different will struggle until we change the system. We spend quite a lot of time trying to fix the women. And actually what we really need to do is to fix the systems. And we've got a real opportunity, I think, now with COVID and the pandemic, which has been horrific. But it has kind of fast forwarded some of the thinking around agile working and how we might reimagine our workplaces to actually be able to respond to the different needs that we all have in terms of the way that we want to live our lives.
Now, at the other end of the spectrum from Harriet Harman, Caroline has chosen Theresa May as her modern role model. Caroline, tell us why you went for Theresa May.
Theresa's always been a brilliant champion of women, from setting up Women to Win and her time. I vividly remember back in 2010 when she came to Romsey and launched my general election campaign about 10 foot up a ladder because she wanted to be supportive. And I found her an incredible prime minister to work for, a sense of duty, diligence and hard work like you would never believe. She was the most incredible, determined woman, and I think badly let down by some in her own party.
Now, as you say, there was a lot going on during Theresa May's premiership, not least Brexit, yet often people seem more obsessed with whether she cried or not. She spoke to Julia Gillard about this for her Women in Leadership book. Do you think the media, the public, give female politicians a hard time about emotion and that sort of aspect of the way they present themselves?
Yeah, I think they really do. And it's very difficult to overcome that. I can remember being asked back in 2019, I was doing an interview with one news station who asked me what my dad thought of my decision to rebel in a vote. And I just looked absolutely incredulously at the interviewer and said, I'm sorry, have you asked, and I was stood with Ed Vasey at the time, I said, have you asked Ed what his mum thinks? I'm a 48-year-old woman, you know, please give me some credit for being able to make my own decisions before having to ask my dad. And I think there is this sort of fixation with women, with their emotions, whether they let their emotions run away with them, whether we've got the right advice from whether it's our partner, our father, you know, bloke down the street, almost as if we're incapable of making up our own minds.
Now, the Conservatives have famously had two female prime ministers, while Labour have had no female leaders. They've had some acting leaders, but no elected leader. But on the other hand, Labour have many more female MPs than the Conservatives. Why is that? Why is it this way around?
I mean, I think we've been incredibly fortunate to have two really strong female prime ministers. And I think the Labour Party has worked incredibly hard to get many more women elected. They've done a great job at that. It was brilliant in the 2019 election to see so many young Labour women coming into Parliament. Of course, we don't have the all-female shortlist that the Labour Party does. But I still think there's a barrier, and Charlotte highlighted it earlier, is that the Labour Party needs to sort of push itself over that line to get a woman leader. And you know, they've got a woman deputy leader in Angela. They've had a woman deputy leader previously in Harriet Harman. But I really think it's time that we see a female leader of the Labour Party.
What does that mean to have a woman in number 10? Do you think that there's a broader impact? I mean, Margaret Thatcher didn't seem particularly interested in kind of encouraging feminism, Theresa May a little more so. Is it just the fact of being a role model, or is there more to it than that?
Oh, I think there's more to it than that. Yeah, sure, being a role model is important. It's important for young women to see women in leadership roles and be able to point to that and say, look, it is possible. But more than that, you need to have, whoever is prime minister, you need to have somebody who has a positive ability to promote women.
Now, moving on to Charlotte, your modern hero crosses the Atlantic to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Tell us about her and why you've picked her.
She's someone that I am particularly inspired by, not only because of the fact that she was the youngest woman ever to serve in the United States Congress at the point at which she was elected. So obviously, as a young MP myself, you know, that's something that I can kind of really identify with, some of the particular issues that she had getting to that point. But I think it's how both refreshingly normal she is. You know, I love watching things like her sort of Instagram stories. You know, she's been engaging with younger voters through different things like Twitch, for example, that, you know, I don't think that any MP on this side of the water has tried to do previously. And I think it's the fact that because she has a real lived experience and understanding as someone who was working as a bartender before she became the candidate, you know, she knows what it's like to live on precarious income, to be on a sort of 0 hours contract, as we would call it over here, you know, to be on minimum wage, and that coming into the political arena hasn't dulled that sense of radicalism. Because I think that one of the things that we often find within politics, and we've kind of alluded to it previously, that sometimes people outside of politics can do more than the people that are in it, is actually how heavy that institutional weight feels when you're pushing against it. Because you'll often ask people and more experienced colleagues, you know, why we do things in certain ways. And their answer essentially boils down to, because that's the way it's always been done. And I think particularly with a lot of the new challenges that we have, whether it's, you know, things like the Green New Deal, for example, the fact that coronavirus has just knocked the economic orthodoxy on its head completely, that, you know, looking for those radical solutions, not only to today's problems, but looking forward further ahead, whether it's, you know, issues like social care here, for example, you know, we can't just be tinkering around the edges of some of these problems. That's the part that I find really inspiring about her. And I think that that's something that a lot of politicians this side of the water can really draw inspiration from.
Now, she is someone who has faced quite tremendous abuse and misogyny from her opponents, including the previous president of the United States. Do you admire how she's been able to deal with that?
Yeah, I think it takes an absolutely incredible amount of resilience. I mean, I think that one of the things I was actually struck by first becoming a candidate and then becoming a member of parliament was actually the severity and the scale of the abuse that I received. I mean, I'd been trolled on social media and things before, but the level of it really took me aback. You know, I had someone going around during the election campaign to let all the Catholic churches in my constituency know that I've had an abortion. You know, I've had death threats, I've had really horrible personal attacks on me, on my family. You know, I recently got a written apology from Amanda Milling, who's the co-chair of the Conservative Party, about anti-Semitic and homophobic abuse that I'd been having from my local Conservative Association. That's not to say that I haven't had, unfortunately, anti-Semitism from people within my own party. Obviously, you know, Labour's issues on that are well documented. But, you know, I look at what I've had and how difficult that's been to deal with on a personal level, on a mental health level, on how you relate to your family and friends. You know, I try not to tag my friends in things on social media anymore because I don't want them to get abuse and things like that, that, you know, it changes the way that you operate. But I look at what I've had and, you know, what someone like Diane Abbott has had, who's, you know, half of the abuse that's been sent to MPs was sent to Diane Abbott personally. You know, to look at the amount that someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has, you know, I don't know how she gets up in the morning.
Now, she is one of perhaps a new generation of young female politicians like yourself. We have Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand. Kamala Harris is someone who's an exciting prospect for the future as vice president, Sana Marin. Do you think that we will get a female president? Do you think there's going to be this sort of flourishing of female leaders in the future around the world?
I hope so, but I think the biggest thing is making sure that there is as big a possible breadth of talent and experience to draw on in all countries of women. Because, of course, you never want the woman who becomes party leader or president or prime minister, depending on which country it's in, to have people say that it was some sort of token appointment just because she's a woman and, you know, it was time to have a woman. I think it's very clear that the more women we have getting elected as MPs, for example, for every party, you know, the more likely you are to have the level and depth and breadth of experience where when they are elected as leader, and it is a question of when, not if, everywhere, people won't be able to make that accusation because they will be the best and brightest as well as being a woman, as opposed to kind of appointment because they are a woman, or with that being an accusation that's held up. I mean, as someone that was selected on an all-women shortlist, you know, I've had people say to me, well, you might have been the best woman, but you're not necessarily the best candidate. And it's like, well, it doesn't work that way. You know, I would like to think that what I've done over the last year in Parliament has showed that whoever I was up against, I would have been able to be selected. But I think whenever there is all women shortlists, you know, that's a way that people try to get at you or to undermine what you're doing.
Thank you, and thank you to everyone for a really fascinating discussion. Do check out www.womeninwestminster.co.uk or the latest edition of the House magazine for the full Women in Westminster list. The 100 list will no doubt provoke more discussion. Get involved in Twitter using the hashtag WIW100 and tell us your thoughts and who'd be on your Women in Westminster list. Thank you so much to my guests today, Caroline Noakes, Charlotte Nichols and Fiona Cannon from Lloyds Banking Group. And thank you to Lloyds Banking Group for kindly sponsoring Women in Westminster, the 100. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like and share on social media and rate and review us to help us get the message out there. I've been Rosa Prince, editor of The House magazine. This podcast was executive produced by James Miller, Alex Hancock and Daniel Bond. The producer and editor was Nick Pilton. Thank you so much for listening and goodbye.